Welcome to this episode of the Essential Church Podcast, an ongoing conversation about some of the most important issues facing the local church. I'm your host, Andrew Arndt, and today I want to take you to a conversation that Daniel Grothy and I had recently with our friend Jared Patrick Boyd. Jared was born and raised in the Nazarene Church and really came to faith in the Vineyard Movement, and like many of us, found that some things in his upbringing were not large enough to hold the wildness of the mystery of God, and were not large enough to give him the full experience of the love of God. And that launched him out on a journey of theology and also discovering the monastic tradition of the church that really has shaped who he is today. He's the founder of a monastic movement called the Order of the Common Life. And in this episode, and he's also a spiritual director, in this episode, we sit down with him to talk all things deconstruction, theology, the love of God, the monastic movement, spiritual direction, and so much more. So without further commentary from me, here's to the conversation.
Well, Jared, thanks for having us here. You've been a pastor in the Vineyard Movement for years. You're a spiritual director. You have started a religious order called the Order of the Common Life. Some of my dear friends that I've known and trusted and loved, I've recently discovered you're their spiritual director. You're the guy that they're on the phone with. And so I think it'd be interesting to just hear a bit of your origin story. Like, how did you become who you became? Who are you? Where do you come from? Who made you that you became this version of Jared Patrick Boyd?
Man, that is a great question. Thank you so much. It's so good to be here, guys. I think the thing that's coming to my mind right now is I think I am who I am because of the people in my life. I think that's true of all of us, that God brings people into our life at various moments. And so a little bit about my people. I'm married to Jamie. We've been married 22 years. We have four girls from age 20 down to age 13. So I'm a girl dad of effectively four teenagers, which is amazing. I love it. It's so great. And I think part of my story, you know, you mentioned I'm a Vineyard pastor. I grew up Nazarene, came to know the Lord as a kid, a grade school kid, probably 10 or 11 years old, had a profound encounter with the Holy Spirit in the Nazarene church, but no one really knew what that was in the church that I grew up in. And then at the age of 16, I walked into a Vineyard church in Cincinnati, Ohio, and had a profound encounter with what I now know is the love of God. And so that was sort of my entryway into the experience of God. And I think the experience of God has profoundly shaped me. I think it's important. Part of my story is that I went through a pretty giant deconstruction like 17 years ago before it was really something that people were talking about. I lost my faith in a pretty profound way. I fell into a pretty deep depression. Was in my second year of marriage. And the thing that led me back was a study of theology and praying the hours. So using Book of Common Prayer and Phyllis Tickle's work, praying prayers that no one else knew I was praying, and prayers that other people had written. I just found that I couldn't really pray. And I know you guys know a little bit about that. That was my entry point into the more contemplative stream and the more monastic stream, which is the stream I draw a lot from these days. And it was in that experience of a more contemplative way of following Jesus that I also discovered the love of God. But this time it wasn't sort of in the big room with loud music and worship. It was actually in a quiet space of early morning prayer. So I think those two sides of the coin, the charismatic and the contemplative, are sort of two halves of me.
So Nazarene little boy, before you knew Jamie, before you had four girls, tell me about two or three of the adults in your life who marked you. So you grew up in the Nazarene church. Who who was an icon for you? Who was someone to look up to? Who showed you the way?
It's a great question. I mean, one of the most beautiful parts of that is that Pastor Bob Mahaffey was my pastor growing up. I have no idea where Bob is, but he's the one who presented the gospel to me on a Sunday morning and led me to faith in Jesus. And he was just a faithful pastor for probably 30 years in Cincinnati, Ohio. A second guy would be a guy named Matt Massey. Matt is now actually pastoring a Vineyard church in Cincinnati. But 30 years ago, he grabbed me as a 16-year-old and invited me to a Bible study, and was one of my first mentors in high school. And it was just goofy stuff. Like, you know, we would watch Seinfeld together, and then we would like talk about our lives with a bunch of guys. So little faithful things like that sort of kept me in the story.
Kept me in the story.
I think about Annie Helwig. She was my high school literature teacher, who I'm still connected with a little bit. But you know, she saw the pain in my life, and she called it out with courage, and was able to help me see that there was pain in my life as a 16, 17, 18-year-old kid. And she was able to speak to that pain and name some of the wounds and help me in a moment when I really needed a lot of help. I mean, there's been people like that my whole life.
It's the people that hold you in the story. I love how you said that. Your story resonates with both of us for sure. You know, you growing up Nazarene and then in the Vineyard. I think that we probably walked a lot of the same footpaths, albeit in different geography. I'm curious, so much of what we want to talk about with you today just deals with kind of this new sort of monasticism that you're leading into and growing. And then also the spiritual direction stuff. We want to get to that. But I do want to take you back kind of to that moment of deconstruction, because it is such a big thing right now. Could you just talk for a little bit about what was it about your experience in the Church of the Nazarene and then later in the Vineyard that wasn't quite big enough for you? Because I think that's the language that a lot of people use, that there was something about, it's not that it was evil. It's that on a lot of fronts, it's just not big enough to hold what they were going through. So can you take us back to those moments? Where did it start to buckle and quake for you?
Yeah, I was a philosophy student at Ohio State in the mid-90s and loved the study of philosophy and was always sort of a pretty naturally curious person around some of the bigger questions. And it wasn't anything in philosophy that got me. I mean, what it was is eventually, so I was on staff with a campus ministry and I was leading a group of students down to an apologetics conference at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I lost my faith at an apologetics conference.
Dear Lord.
It was one of these moments where we were sort of in this sort of session about one of those ridiculous questions about like, what about the person on the island that never hears the gospel? And
sure.
And it was just sort of this back and forth thing. And it wasn't the philosophy that was getting me. It was the story just completely fell apart for me. And so I don't think, so if I could answer it like really succinctly, that no one had told me how expansive the love of God really, really is. And I was caught in a story that was about other things. And I just sort of remember walking out of this room at this apologetics conference to say, like, if this is what your church is, I'm out. And Lord, if you've ever saved me once, you're going to have to do it again. And that was the beginning of my depression and the beginning of the Lord's really deep work in me over the next 18 months to lead me back. And it was through the study of theology where I needed the story to make sense to me. And I, you know, those big books that N.T. Wright wrote, all of those big ones. I read all of those. I read the first one, New Testament, People of God. I read it three times. I read the first 130 pages where he does his epistemological sort of framework. 10 times. And through the study of theology, I I met the living Christ again.
Wow.
And then through the contemplative prayer, there was a study of theology. I met him in my mind. And then through contemplative prayer, I met him in my heart.
Wow.
And God began to just heal me of all sorts of things, in that period. Lots of tears, lots of crying out to the Lord.
Yeah.
In prayer. And then I discovered traditions that took seriously, the reality of God's love for us. Mm. I don't know why I had missed out on that. I don't blame that on the Nazarene church. I don't blame that on my upbringing. I couldn't quite grasp the love of God, in the way in which I now do. That makes much more sense.
So when you're working with, it just strikes me as a mercy that you had your deconstruction moment at 23, 24, 25, whatever it was. You were young and you were already going, gosh, I'm not going to travel to conferences to talk about stupid desert island questions that, like, I'm not going to spend my life on trivialities. It strikes me as a mercy that happened early for you. But what do you want to say to the people who are going through that? Mm-hmm. Like, what's a guide? What's a handbook for walking through deconstruction? What are some things to pay attention to for the person listening who goes, yeah, that makes sense to me?
Yeah, man. In my book, which we can talk about, like, there's a chapter on this actually about staying in the river. Mm. So I have this analogy where I view the church as like this winding river, where deconstruction is like the banks of the river are being negotiated,
right,
all the time throughout the history of the church, and we have to understand that some banks of the river of the church are going to need to be fortified because they're very, very important and we can't lose them.
Mm-hmm.
Some banks that we think are ones that we just have to keep are going to continue to crumble, and we will later realize, like, oh, that wasn't quite as important as we thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not here to overdetermine what those are for the church.
Right.
That's our job as the church, which I think you guys would agree. So my first encouragement is to people is to stay in the church, mm-hmm. and let the church become a womb. And a hearth where we can try to learn how to burn as hot as we could possibly burn. But the second thing I would say to people is find other people who know the love of God and follow those people.
Yes, for sure. That's right.
Yes.
So you'll probably picking up a theme here. I've come to believe that the only thing in the end that really changes us is the experience of the love of God.
That's it.
And it's that there's so much in the way of that in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we start talking about spiritual disciplines or rule of life or way of life, it's not just to help us live better. It's to help us gain access to the things that are holding us back from actually seeing the way that God loves us and cares for us.
Jared, let me ask you this. What if you're a person for whom the deconstruction is in large part precipitated by the church context that they're in? And both of us are big believers in the vow of stability, stay put as long as you can. And Eugene Peterson talked about that all the time. But there are times when it is time to pull the ripcord for the sake of your soul and you have to exit. How do you find yourself counseling people in those kinds of situations? You know, what kind of decision criteria do you give them that help them know it's time for you to step out and find a new community of faith? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I'm pretty slow to ever encourage people to step out of a community of faith. Like you guys, you know, I'm a fan of Wendell Berry and Eugene Peterson, and I believe all of that. And so I'm primarily asking, particularly in spiritual direction, people to pay attention to what God might have for you in this place, even with people who don't quite understand you or don't understand what you're going through. Obviously, if there's situations of abuse or sort of theological divergence that feel like incompatible with the direction that one feels like God is leading them, But then the question is, like, you have to find a church. Mm-hmm. Like, and so then my counsel is like, okay, let's go really slowly. Who are some people in your city mm-hmm. that you might be able to explore life together with? Mm-hmm. And until you do that work, mm-hmm. you just got to stay put and let the church be a womb mm-hmm. of your formation. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So yeah. spiritual direction. There are people listening right now who go, what is that? That's woo-woo for them. That's, you know, like, ooh. Mm-hmm. Like, take us into Spiritual Direction 101. What is it? How does the Spirit use it? What does it look like in a session? Take people into the story.
Yeah, usually when people ask me that, I may ask a question back to them, like, who do you have in your life that is helping you pay attention to the work of God in you? And some people will say, oh, like this friend or so, and I'll say, well, tell me what that looks like. Mm-hmm. Most people in the end of that conversation realize that they have no one helping them pay attention to what God is doing in their life. Mm-hmm. And then my response is, well, that's what I do. I help you pay attention mm-hmm. to what God is doing in your life, what your prayers are like, how you're praying, how you wish you were praying, maybe how you're not praying. And that usually happens over the course of a pretty long relationship. And I meet with people about once a month for about an hour. And a session starts really slowly. We welcome the presence of the Holy Spirit. We sit with some silence and we just ask what might be bubbling up for you in your life right now. And then we just start there. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I will say is that the spiritual direction world has always been rooted in the tradition of monasticism and religious orders and the priesthood. And it's really only been in the past 40 or 50 years that spiritual directors in broadly Western culture have been trained outside of those like institutions. Yep. And for those who are familiar with spiritual direction, one of the things I would say, and one of the things that we're starting to talk more about is the way it's come down into evangelicalism, broadly speaking, I think has become a little watered down in that much of the training of spiritual directors has been separated from theological education. And historically, spiritual directors have been people who have like real theological training. Mm-hmm. And I think increasingly, mm-hmm. if you're going to entrust the care of your soul to somebody, that person should sort of be very deeply tied to the history of
definitely
of Orthodox.
This is different than life coaching.
They're not all. There are spiritual directors and there are spiritual directors. And right. I've told
yes,
people that,
right.
you know, like, and some of them are not going to lead you. They have a loose grip on Orthodoxy.
Yep.
mm-hmm. And they're not going to lead you into the church. So I think I'm seeing that as well. And I think what you want in a good spiritual director, besides just the giftedness of being a spiritual director, is do you share my commitments to historical Christian Orthodoxy and to the church? If not, I don't know where, like, which direction are we going? Right. It's important
that's exactly
to try to
suss
that out. Let me ask you this question. I have a couple questions connected to this notion of spiritual formation. Just clarify for our listeners, what's the difference between spiritual direction and therapy? And maybe how do those work together if you're in a place where you're like, woof, my life is in trouble? How can those things work together? How are they different from one another?
Yeah, so therapy, my own experience of therapy and my understanding of therapy is generally like there's like a precipitating problem that's emerging. Mm-hmm. And you go to a therapist to help you sort of sort out that problem. So for me, I'm happy to share, like I had my oldest three girls were in a pretty bad car accident about 2 years ago. They flipped their vehicle on the highway and I was pretty close enough where I was able to get there, you know, before the tow truck and the ambulance. And I come upon the highway and my girls are standing outside the car and the car is flipped over. And what I later discovered is that was a pretty traumatic event for me. that required me to go into therapy. Mm-hmm. I needed to work that out in therapy. Yep. So there's like a precipitating thing.
Yep.
And I needed to unpack some of that in therapy.
Yep.
Spiritual direction is more like there's nothing really driving, like we're not necessarily trying to solve a problem.
Yep.
We're just trying to be attentive to what is God doing in your life? What is he inviting you to? How is God loving you? How are you paying attention to that love?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the primary difference is that therapy sort of has an end point,
yep.
a terminus, yep. and is there to solve a problem, and spiritual direction is not.
Yeah, therapy is like something happened in your body and your mind, and we might be able to do something about that. And it's a little bit like physical
right.
therapy, you know, like if you messed up your knee, you need a physical therapist to help you put your knee back together. And the spiritual director might have something to say about that insofar as that is part of your life. But it's a bigger question.
That's right.
I liked the language that you used on your website of noticing and nurturing the work of God. Is that right? Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what spiritual direction is. So in theory, that's what pastors are for their congregations. Eugene Peterson said that in what is maybe my mm-hmm. favorite Eugene book, Working the Angles.
Yeah,
that the whole mm-hmm. ministry is the ministry of spiritual direction. We're trying to notice and nurture the work of God in the life of the person in front of us, but also in the congregation in front of us. So why is it important that pastors have spiritual directors?
Yeah, because, you know...
Like, shouldn't they be so good at this that they can kind of do it for themselves since they're doing it for everybody else?
I mean, I love the... I can hear Daniel's laughter, and it's so tongue-in-cheek, but it's... We can't see what we can't see,
mm-hmm.
you know, and... you know, even Jesus himself coming out of the wilderness needed angels to tend to him.
Yeah.
Jeez. Ooh.
And so, like, if a pastor is thinking, like, I've got this all together, just look at the life of Jesus. It's like angels came and tended. So a spiritual director mm-hmm. is someone that cares for your soul in the way that I think it's Gregory of Nazianzus talks about this. And Andrew, I know that you love these old guys too.
Mm-hmm.
From your work, but he talks mm-hmm. about like a surgeon and a scalpel, and the whole field of medicine in the early church was compared to the mm-hmm. work of a spiritual director, that there's got to be this individualized care for your soul because yeah. we are not all the same. We all have the same form of sickness, but it's also unique to me. My form of sin is very unique to me.
So I'm going to ask you one follow-up question to this. And thank you for reminding me of that, because there was a number of them for sure. And Gregory the Great, you know, who was a monk himself and then eventually became Pope, his whole kind of pastoral approach was Jesus is the great physician, and being a pastor is about
that's
the
right.
care of souls. And that's what churches are to be, places where souls are cared for. So when you're doing direction for pastors, Jared, what are the big sicknesses that you're seeing in pastors that need to be cured? Just talk some big themes here. You know what I mean? Like, where is the sickness that is unto death unless we get it dealt with? Where are you seeing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think pastors suffer from the same sicknesses that everybody does. You know, and classically, I like to talk about those sicknesses with the early church's concept of the passions. You know,
yep.
the vainglory and pride and gluttony and lust and greed and avarice and sadness. And,
yeah.
And I think that the challenge of being a pastor is, for some reason, we have this belief that as pastors that somehow if we're struggling, that it's not okay. And I think in many ways, people in our churches think that we should not struggle with these kinds of things, with vainglory, with pride, with avarice,
mm-hmm.
with anxiety and fear and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if this is a direct answer to your question, but I think one of the things that I would reflect back in my experience of doing spiritual direction with leaders more generally
mm-hmm.
is the thing I noticed that God is doing in so many leaders' lives is turning their shoulders towards greater attentiveness to their family.
Hmm.
The whole world wants us to be focused on our church and the growth of our church and the care of our congregation. And what I just noticed that God is doing, I'm obviously going to go into detail about that, but like, is that I'm so pleased that God over and over and over again tends to turn leaders and pastors' attention towards
to their families,
to their family, their kids, their wife, how that's going. That's where most of the formational work I see happening in the lives of leaders. And I'm very pleased that that's what God's doing.
Wow.
And if you can solve that, if the family can be well and whole, mm-hmm. your calendar won't be as full. Mm. Like I know mm-hmm. that's silly, but Andrew and I spend a lot of our time, and I'm sure you've seen this, and people come in and really, and I don't say this with a shred of sarcasm. I say this like with almost the fear of the Lord, but it sometimes our work feels like reparenting other people's children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for what was missed mm-hmm. in those most sacred moments and sacred spaces, there was inattention, there was wounding, there was disinterest, they were asleep at the wheel, the parents. It's refamilying people. It's retraining,
that's right.
reparenting. So if pastors can be good parents or, you know, have the home well, you can rise mm-hmm. to give something to the world. And I think this is why Timothy and Titus talk about, if you want to be a leader in the church, if you want to be an elder, an overseer, a deacon, whatever, you can't manage the household of God if you can't manage your own home. Mm-hmm. So that I love mm-hmm. that, turning their shoulders to a greater attention to their family.
That's a great phrase.
Yeah. I mean, I think our role as pastors, spiritual directors, is to become spiritual fathers and mothers.
Yeah.
And like, you know, this, the Apostle Paul says, you know, there are not many fathers yeah. among you. Yeah. I came to you as a father. So Daniel, just to support your point, I do think that this is really important work.
Okay. Let me ask you about the communal aspect of what God is calling you to do. So you are doing one-on-one, you're healing people, you're tending souls, you're sitting down in spiritual direction. That's fantastic. That's beautiful. That's a part of the work. But you're also on this mission to build community. Eugene Peterson talked about the church of the future needs to become a monastery without walls. Mm-hmm. And I just heard you talk about what you guys are trying to do to build urban monasteries, and you're chasing a place in Cincinnati. Lord bless it. Lord provide for it. Lord make it happen. Mm-hmm. But take us into that. Why is that a burden on your heart? What are you seeing in our society mm-hmm. that demands that this is the gift that the church gives to the world? What's going on?
Yeah, great question. Just so I don't stumble across this or somebody else. I'm in Columbus, Ohio.
Did
which
I
is
say
just
Cincinnati?
Cincinnati
so. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Matt Massey.
I don't want any of your...
Matt Massey.
Yeah,
was
Matt
he
Massey
in Cincinnati?
He's in Cincinnati.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's where I... Yeah. Columbus. Yes.
No worries. I just didn't want anybody from Cincinnati being like, man, where is this going to be?
My bad.
So a couple steps back, I would say is that there's so much... We have a lot of tailwind around spiritual formation in the church right now. There's a lot of people doing a lot of great work around, we got to dig deeper wells, or the church is not going to make it. So I'm super pleased at that conversation around way of life and rule of life. Obviously as part of our work as an order, we have a rule of life that we invite people into, and we work with congregations to help them imagine a congregational way of life together. I think the thing that I'm trying to address is that over time, it feels like spiritual formation has become such an individualized pursuit.
Yes, sir.
You know, I think Foster and Dallas Willard, man, what a gift they were. Mm-hmm. But they were writing in a time in evangelicalism that was still radically individualized. And I think that while they were all pulling from the well of monasticism, the way it got birthed out into broadly speaking evangelicalism became another individualized pursuit. Mm-hmm. And rule of life and way of life has never been about the individual. It's always been about, this is how we live together.
That's right.
And so I think that churches are and need to continue to lean into that. And then I think part of the church sort of universal is and has been religious orders like the Franciscans and the Jesuits, the Benedictines, all of these orders that have crept up and grown in a unique way in the last 2,000 years, has been broadly unavailable to those of us outside the Catholic Church for the past 500
right.
years.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to address that. We're trying to reimagine what it would be like to be a Franciscan or a Jesuit outside the Catholic Church in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're inviting people into a shared common commitments, rhythm of life, and a 3 to 4 year formation pathway at the end of which they have an opportunity to take first vows of 1 to 5 years. So we're drawing very heavily from the tradition, and our hope is eventually to have an urban monastery. We think that's probably like a 5 to 10 year project, but we're trying to sow some seed for that work right now.
I so appreciate this. I'm, you know, we're all invested in this idea, actually. Like, I think about your most recent book, Daniel, Power of Place. I mean, that's taking Benedict's vow of stability and trying to think it through. My most recent one, Streams in the Wasteland, was Desert Fathers and Mothers. What I was surprised about when I really dove into them is how communal they were. Mm-hmm. And you had some hermits that lived by themselves. But generally, that was actually discouraged, that would be destructive to your soul if you could do it at all. Like, you had to be in a really exalted place. Mostly you did it together. And then, of course,
that's right.
All the work that you're doing, Jared, so appreciate it. And also couldn't agree more about like the Dallas Willard, Richard Foster angle. I think that they did give us something. They ignited a conversation that had been dormant for a long time in evangelicalism. But I do think that there is a tendency for that to get sucked into kind of like live your best life now, American boutique spirituality. Like, I've just curated these special disciplines that work for me and I'm becoming like Jesus by myself. And it doesn't work that way. But the real big challenge is, you know, like, you've got these urban monasteries that you're dreaming about and working towards, but most of us do live dispersed, and we live, that's just the way that our lives are set up. So here we are in Colorado Springs in a suburban sprawl. Talk to us, just like, try to put the cookies on the bottom shelf for us. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about what the monastic movement might have to say to us and our fragmentation and how we might envision together a way of being together that is driven by the gospel and deeply humanizing, you know? Talk to us about that.
Yeah.
How would we do it? What are you, what do you find yourself saying to groups that are trying to lean into this way of life?
There's an ancient proverb that basically says, the cowl does not make the monk, or the habit does not make the monk, which is like, you don't become a monk because you put on the dress.
Yep.
And the robe of a monk. And so there's a sense in which, and Thomas Merton talks about this all the time, but there's like something that happens at the heart and soul level of a human being that is able to lean into this tradition without necessarily going to a monastery or putting on a brown robe and going barefoot throughout the city. And so what we invite people into is a 6-month exploration of our rule of life, which is made up of 12 commitments, nothing out of the ordinary in those commitments. And we do that in cohorts of people. Increasingly, those cohorts are localized. So we have about 30 folks like in Austin, Texas, that are going through cohorts. And we have folks all over the world that are going through cohorts that are dispersed in those 6 months. And then out of that 6-month journey, we keep inviting people into the next phase, of formation, which is like a 3-year novitiate process. And it's always in community with other people who are leaning in the same direction. Ideally, what we hope will happen over time is that in a local church, maybe there is, a handful of people who join the order of the common life, are deeply formed in the love of God, and then become evangelists in their local church for the transformational power of the love of God. So that's sort of the very long-term vision. So like, I'm thinking about you guys there at New Life. If 1% of the people at New Life came through and decided to join the order of the common life, our sort of theory of change is that those people's lives would make ripples of the love of God throughout your community.
It's happening. Kate Weiss is her name. She is one of our dearest friends. She's in the order of the she's in the process. And we're having dinner with them almost every week. And Kate is making ripples in this congregation with her love, with her prophetic sensitivity, with her dream work, with her, she's just, her hospitality. You've never been in a home that is warm and inviting like you, like the Weiss home. And so I can say this as a pastor, like those of you who are listening, check out The Order of the Common Life. I could not recommend it any more highly. Go online, look at it, watch the videos. It's a very beautiful process, and the fruit is able to be tasted. Let me just kind of take one more pass at trying to flesh this out for people who don't yet understand what the urban monastery could be. So, housing crisis all over America, affordable housing. You have to be wealthy to be able to put your parents up in a senior care facility. I'm hearing sometimes $5,000 to $10,000 a month to have your. I mean, it's so expensive. What do you do with widows and widowers who are living in their homes by themselves? What do you do with Christians who are celibate, who've dedicated their lives to following Jesus as a single person? What do you do with, as you said earlier, sexual minorities, people who have a traditional biblical sexual ethic that would lead them to resist the urge, but they understand themselves to be gay, you know? How do they find family? Single people who are just building their lives. Like, think about buying an apartment complex or an urban monastery with 300 units where 300 humans could live their lives. And you have morning prayers. You share your meals together. You have people to check up on you. The lonely, Psalm 68, the lonely are set into families. There are expectations. There are checking in. There's accountability. We're not just Christians dispersed to the four winds that come to church 1.5 times a month, but we are Christians living in a community of people who are, as iron sharpens iron, sharpening one another. I think, and this is a burden of mine, so to hear you talk about this, this is waking something up in me, and I just want to say it in public here for people so that they can't say no one ever put the idea in front of them. But I think the way forward for the church, one of the ways forward for the church in the next 50 years, in our lifetime, will be building communities where all of these diverse groups of people can come, they can literally be housed, they can be in family, they can have people helping them become more like Jesus, and then the church can go out into the community to make a ripple. So just spitball with me, think out loud, urban monasteries.
Yeah, I love everything you just said. And, you know, oftentimes when I show up to places and cast some vision like that, you know, most people are like, that's a total pipe dream. And you know what? You're right. It totally is. And I think that God can do it. He's done it before. And while our current culture is not really dispositioned to the kind of thing that you and I are describing right now, I think that one of the most prophetic ways the church could be the church is to create things like this. I mean, why do all the real estate developers get to have all the fun?
Exactly.
In shaping our cities?
Yeah, for sure.
So we're the model we're presently working on, and we're just in the iterative stage right now. But what we imagine is a building in our city that could house about 30 to 40 long-term full-time residents in a kind of dorm style situation, shared dining, shared living, you know, a chapel, you know, prayer at particular times. And then those people would host another 50 to 60 retreat rooms where people can come into the city and, you know, live like a monk a handful of days, a few times a year, on an overnight retreat Or just they could show up for the day and be immersed in the rhythms of the community and in the quiet, maybe receive spiritual direction, get some inner healing prayer, maybe see a counselor, all within like a few days. If you've ever talked to somebody who's been to a monastery on a retreat, mostly what I hear people come back with is, man, I've got to do that more often. And then you talk to them 2 years later and they still haven't done it again. Because it's so, to get to the Abbey of Gethsemane or to get to a monastery is so hard. It's so challenging. And so what we want to do is we want to bridge the gap where, you know, a mom of three kids could on a Thursday, you know, show up at 9 a.m. and stay until Friday afternoon. And she's been immersed in something that, that is there for her to care for her soul in a way that is, she can get there in 10 minutes. You know, and she just shows up. Our hope is that people could hand over their phone at the front desk and that we could just help people, you know, decompress for 24 or 48 hours at a time.
This is going to heal you in a way that a day at the spa never could.
That's right.
And exactly we Americans have such a narrow vision for how to be restored. And the church historically has had a very thick, broad, sophisticated vision for what it means to be restored, repeopled, rehumanized. And so you're talking about building a place where that is the norm. And I can hardly think of a list of 10 things that would be more important than this happening. Amen. So may God answer all of your prayers, Jared Patrick Boyd. And may he raise up these pockets all over our country.
Amen. Jared, thank you. I just listening to you, I was thinking you're dropping seeds in the ground for a new kind of imagination of how to be the church. And I'm so grateful for that. And I know that this is a, we were saying off camera that this is something that the Spirit, I think, is dispersing widely across the church. It's happening everywhere. It's really fun to meet a kindred soul doing it in a different context. Also, keep going. You were telling us that it's been really difficult, but you're on the right track. So just keep running at it. I wonder if you wouldn't just take a minute to let people know where to find you online. I also know that you have done some writing around this. So if you you might have a little book over there that you could show us. That'd be kind of nice.
Yeah, absolutely. So my website's just jaredpatrickboyd.com. It's nothing fancy. It just points to a couple books I've written. My first book is Imaginative Prayer with InterVarsity Press 2017. And then my recent book is Finding Freedom in Constraint.
So good.
It's reimagining spiritual disciplines as a communal way of life. So a lot of what we talked about here is embedded into that book. And the book is just like a thimbleful of the work that we're doing with the Order of the Common Life.
So great. Thanks for that. Blessings on you, Jared. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah. Much love. Thank you, guys.